Welcome once again to Innovation Deciphered. This week, I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by Alistair Law. Alistair is the CEO and founder of a very interesting organisation called Vertical Meadows. And in this session, we'll be discussing about how innovation has been brought to bear in the engineering sector to make sure that we're addressing the needs from a biodiversity point of view. So I'm sure you'll agree that this is a really interesting subject, and you'll hear about Alistair's journey from a balcony in Paris to being a nominee for the Earthshot Prize for 2024. So Alistair, delighted you're able to join us today. Really looking forward to hearing about your journey. One thing that struck me about Vertical Meadow, I'll ask you to explain a bit more in detail about that business, was the fact that you and I are both involved in the construction sector, and we're often blamed for causing the loss of biodiversity.
Yeah.
And you and I have been involved in projects over many years, me more than you, clearly, but where we that just hasn't been on the agenda. What I'm particularly interested in is how the circle seems to have turned around now, that you are looking to repair some of the
damage
that we have caused in the past by bringing biodiversity solutions into the built environment. So maybe you just take us through your journey from engineering into biodiversity and what Vertical Meadows is all about and why it exists.
Yeah, so I guess, I've been, as you like, in the industry as a consultant for Arup for, I guess I joined them in 2003. And I'm still doing a day a week, just supporting them on a couple of high profile projects. But this question of, my journey, it started with, as a structural engineer, designing buildings and aiming for efficiency, and then questioning what was the point of that efficiency at the end of it, because often things for rationalization reasons became bigger at the end of it. And I also felt there wasn't that connection with the people, the users. I felt disconnected with the whole purpose of the building in the first place. And that's questioned me the kind of value of just pure optimization. And I felt it was really important, which took me into the facade world. And the facade world, for me, was quite interesting, actually. That dialogue you start having with the architect, actually with the client, where actually, this is the thing that speaks to people, and this is the thing, I wouldn't say that they only care about, it's one of the key dimensions of the building and very key to how it fits into place. And on that journey of fitting into place, then questioning what is a good place. And that started, during sort of COVID period, and actually Vertical Meadow concept came out in about 2013-14, when I was kind of questioning about how we could bring greening back into our cities. But it really,
whoa.
Go on.
It's more romantic than that. Did I read something about you on your balcony in Paris?
Yes, okay, yeah. Good point. So it started really with me cleaning a coffee mug in the morning, actually, and I started cleaning this mug, and I was like, this kind of sponge is a bit like a synthetic soil. And I was like, and then it made me think of, bizarrely, aluminium foams, because I had seen some samples of aluminium foams, and I was like, maybe I could grow things on aluminium foams. So I started playing with aluminium foam, and I realized that wasn't going to grow things very much because it didn't hold any water. And then through that, I ended up going to see some grow shops, and they were like, you can set up a hydroponic system quite easily, etc. So I started just playing with very small samples of aluminium foam initially, and then trying different substrates. And I was
more as a hobby or
more as a
business idea at that stage?
No, it was definitely a hobby cross. Kind of, I could see there was something there. I felt there was a clear need for greenery in our cities, and I was living in Paris. Paris is famous for a guy called Patrick Blanc, who has put green walls up all around Paris. But I looked to them, and I'd read about them, and they were quite complex objects, and they were from his past in Indonesia and his experience. And I kind of said, well, actually, what I really want is a bit of park. And putting that onto Vertical, and I, And I also realise one couldn't afford to have these fancy gardens everywhere. So actually, the route was something a bit less complex and something that ideally needs less maintenance, which kind of led me back to, can we just mow something? And so, yeah, the kind of romantic bit was playing on a balcony. I remember it was a really hot summer. It was like 35, 36 degrees at what certain days. I was like, and I just kept watering the hell out of this kind of small panel, and it kept growing. And I was like, wow, there's something here. And then from the discussions with, at the time, ex-colleagues from ARA, they were like, I think you've got something there. We're really interested. And then Arup came in, actually invested in the idea.
So they saw the business application rather than you, or?
Well, they knew me and they thought, oh, Alistair, a pretty safe pair of hands. There seems to be something there. They saw the business application. Although that was 2014, so we were pretty early on in the cycle. What we've seen in the last 2 or 3 years is totally different interest.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So we went through that, spoke with lots of major product suppliers, so all the big names that we know in the facade world were interested in it. And but clearly at the time it was still a bit unusual. And so what I've realised about any ideas, we started developing the idea. We had samples up in Singapore, California, London. So with Arup, we were testing it in Berlin. And we're like, okay, this works. We can get this to work. It was a very crude system at that time. It was a pre-production system.
And at that time, what was the driver? Because it was pre-regulation.
It was pre-regulation.
So was it considered just to be a good thing to do? It was morally right, or was there anything else that was?
Yeah. I guess I'd always been in the sustainability part of ARA. I'd always driven that in whatever I did. So when I talked about optimization in my early structural days, that really was about minimizing material and ideally, yeah, making and integrating. I mean, one of my earliest projects was on Tooley Street, where we had ducts, which were columns, which was all these things were doing multiple things, and that was all about efficiency and ideally overlap. But the kind of greenery, why were we thinking about greenery then? For me, it was about well-being. I'd gone on to study and done a master's thesis on how nature was really important to people's psychiatric health and to reduce stress. And at that time I was like, well, this is key. And we're living in these cities, which are barren landscapes. And Paris, where I was, is a prime example of a very mineral place, and much more than London is. And it just became this has got to be the future. And actually Paris, interestingly, because it's so mineral there, the mayor of Paris has placed such a massive emphasis on greening and actually turning a lot of the highways into walking routes back in Paris. And so there was a clear drive. Paris was definitely saying everyone should be doing this. And that was in about 2014-15. And then you started to see this movement also appearing in Berlin already, and then London, the mayor of London was starting to bring in, I mean, even Boris did his part in bringing greening up the agenda, and through some key figures in the GLA, the urban greening factor was born, probably in about, I remember speaking to people in about 2015 of it, so it was very much the start.
Well, it was all its time then.
Oh, it was its time. And we'd moved into a city where we wanted to cycle around more, and we started questioning how far was this going to go. So I think, but in ARA, what we were seeing is we were seeing interest, but we weren't seeing, okay, we're going to build a load of this. And so it kept me doing my role in ARA for longer. And that kind of, but it also allowed us to follow the interest and see how that interest was changing. And I think, I mean, this is obviously talking about how ideas come to place, and it's all about timing.
Timing and funding.
But for me, those two are the same thing, because you get the timing, then you can attract the funding. If you haven't, I mean, if the market's not there.
Sure.
And that's what we've really seen from our.
But that's interesting because at the time when you first started, there wasn't really a market for it.
No,
but Arup saw an interest.
Arup saw the potential. Yeah, there's a foresight.
There's clearly a market for it now.
There's clearly a market now, and that's just we're starting to see interest everywhere actually. Yeah. And but yeah, the funding thing is key, and I guess you also as a startup, you go through different phases of funding. And so you start off with normally people who know you, trust you, and as we all know, it's not just about a great idea, it's also about the person delivering it and make sure do they have the network, do they have the ability to take
passion.
It.
And the passion. Yeah, they're driven by it, yeah.
I think that's it. And so what I've found is that although the early days were quite tough, because you're like, yes, I think I'm onto something, but you weren't getting the market and pulled in. But what really helped for us actually was a conversation I had with Clear Channel, who are one of our biggest clients now. And
was that by design or just serendipity?
By design.
Okay.
As in, we realised we were effectively putting billboards up around our cities, and whether that's on a hoarding for a client that's talking about kind of their development, or whether that's for Clear Channel kind of talking about what's important for them. And actually it came from a very nourishing conversation about the role of biodiversity in our cities. And so the likes of Clear Channel, some of the biggest clients are the cities, and so they are constantly interrogating what our cities, what are they requesting, what do they need. And they were seeing this drive that greening is important and improving their environment, and using, I guess, the levers such as these contracts they have with cities as a way of providing them some of what they want and some of that what they're needing. And as we all know, London is trying to become that green city to kind of encourage talent. And so we're starting to see multiple drivers, which are, I mean, Singapore has done obviously a great job at kind of talking about well-being and how it can change the economic viability of a city by making people come to Singapore to live, to kind of travel to. And so I think that, the economic drivers of greening have kind of grown, and that, but it has been at a low level of city. I mean, you've seen it through the C40 cities. It's been there, it's been talked about, and now it's starting to hit some of the regulatory requirements.
Yeah.
And that's where we're starting to see kind of real interest with us, is it's going into planning permission for urban greening factor, it's going to code of construction for greening of hoardings. It's also most recently got biodiversity net gain regulations. So all of this is kind of changing the discussion around greening. And and there's greening, which is often seen as aesthetical, whereas we like to talk about it being functional. A lot of people, you might hear the word ecosystem services. And that, as an engineer, I like that as a principle much more than we're going to stick a pretty wall on.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because if we go back that engineering killed biodiversity, what I'm particularly impressed is you're using engineering principles to bring biodiversity back in again. And not just in the product, but also how that product is monitored, maintained, and enabled to flourish thereafter. So just take us through the thought process there. And
I think it's an interesting discussion. My view was the current systems out there, where it come from green roof technology, were kind of plastic, were for me stuff that you would not normally associate with the construction world.
Yeah.
And I kind of said, well, actually, how do we make this quick and easy to put up? And for me to not reinvent a new process for the construction industry. So on our hoarding product, it really was, well, what's the most basic thing you put around a construction site? It's often monoflex on scaffolding. Our first projects with Grosvenor and the Crown Estate were covering scaffoldings with our temporary wrap system. And so it was like, well, let's build off the monoflex, let's make sure the scaffolders can build it, so we use standard monoflex fixings, and it really was about it. How do we, not only about the idea, but how do we actually build it in a way that no one really has to change the way they do stuff? Because as we all know, innovation is difficult to get over the line in the first place.
Yeah.
If you can keep it as aligned with current practices, it's just it's more of a swap rather than a reinvent kind of. So that was for our wrap, and then for our planning product, very similar. I was like, well, actually, if I take my client hat on and I said, what do the clients want? Ideally, we want a single responsibility for the whole of the envelope. So ideally, we hand this back in to the facade contractor's package. We build it in a way that they can do it exactly how they've always done it. So our system is literally a metal rain screen, a hook on. We're bolting onto standard rain screen systems, which are already in existence. So we're just adding another layer, a bit exactly like the wrap, where we've taken a Monoflex, added another layer. Here we're taking a rain screen panel, adding another layer. And that turns it into quite a recognisable, I guess, simple in people's mind system.
It's another module. Yeah.
It's another module. Yeah. And then you talk about the data and all that kind of side. Yeah. And it is also that I'm plant agnostic in the sense I'm passionate about biodiversity, but for me, a dandelion on a wall is as valuable as a bougainvillea, and actually I would say it's more valuable because it's actually more useful for biodiversity, and it's the bedrock of biodiversity. Yeah. So what the fact that we've chosen wildflowers, which is so important for biodiversity, is also they're the most robust species out there. If we weren't here, they will still be here. So if you're going to stick anything on a vertical wall, you want something that will grow under any circumstance.
So there's an education base, isn't there? Because a number of us have grown up that they're weeds.
Yeah, they're weeds.
Whereas from a biodiversity point of view, they're valuable.
They're enormously valuable.
So how do you go about ensuring that this... Because you spoke earlier that you were underwhelmed with the work you were doing before, but you didn't feel it was contributing to society in the way you wanted it to.
Exactly.
How do you ensure that you actually get the positive impacts of this society, that people do start to appreciate that in a different way?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I kind of look at it and I say, actually, these weeds that we've kind of named them are kind of probably the wrong plant in the wrong place, or right plant in the wrong place, whatever you want to say. But whereas in reality, once you elevate the dandelion onto the vertical, people are like, wow, dandelion on the vertical, that's quite interesting. And you've turned this kind of plant, which people would ignore, into an exhibit. Mm. And I think that's quite an exciting moment for me, is that actually by turning it, deforming it in a certain way, people look at it in a different way. And I think that's really interesting. And then working alongside the Wildlife Trust, so we've teamed up with the Wildlife Trust, we teamed up with Bug Life and a Professor Nigel Dunnett, who did all the Olympic Park. That really was a kind of, for me, an education about plants and biodiversity and what plants. I mean, we haven't just randomly chosen some wildflowers out there. The wildflowers on our walls are designed for an urban environment and attracting biodiversity, and that will vary geographically. And we're looking at projects in Germany. We're trying to make sure that we're tailoring to the local environment, because fundamentally, these walls are not islands. They're back to making our cities better. They're communicating with other green spaces. They're sharing seeds. Yeah. We get stuff blown into our walls, and that's quite exciting. That it's almost like a partnership with the other green space. And if you talk about wildlife, everyone talks about wildlife corridors, and that's the Crown Estate have a wildlife corridor going up there, Regent Street, which goes from St James's Park to Regent's Park, and that's what we need to think of our cities as, kind of lots of stepping stones, but valuable stepping stones, because we did a recent piece with Bug Life, and they talked about a bee has only enough energy to fly 300 metres. So in theory, we need a pollinator source 300 metres between all our big green spaces to make sure. And we're talking about solitary bees, because everyone talks about honeybees, and everyone's like, oh, they're great. And then I'm sure you hear a lot, and it's like I said, we've got too many hives in our cities. And actually, if you speak to ecologists, those are domestic bees. They're things we brought in, and actually they're taking the food from bumblebees. But yeah, back to the kind of tech side, it really is this agnostic kind of view I took, was this is a system. This is a system that supports biodiversity. How can we best deliver this system? And we break it down to species, make sure we have the best experts in that for delivering biodiversity, and break it down to our irrigation system. So as we're trying to layer in machine learning into our systems, trying to iron out errors and collect data all across our systems, because we think that's key. Everyone has seen a crappy green wall,
yeah.
and that typically means water or power has been turned off.
The other thing
is putting these walls in the right place. Yeah. Otherwise, if you get the orientation wrong, you're gonna spend a fortune on maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
That's the deal. If you've got the plant in the wrong place, then you're gonna have to replace it a lot. And then moving down in that kind of tech thing was actually, how do we, on the maintenance side, yes, we've got the real-time monitoring of data, and then actually we just want to simply mow it.
Yeah.
And we've been talking, that's what meadow needs. Mm. I mean, in the countryside, it's a tractor pulling a big mower, and you cut it, and there's no individual plant kind of care. And that's our view on it as well. Let's just shear it off, and we've got hedge trimmers, and so we're trying to effectively, I say industrialise it, that sounds as though we're almost denaturing what we're trying to do, but it is to make it just cheaper in every sense, because if we really want to have impact on biodiversity, then to be honest, it's not going to be having pretty gardens out there. We've got to accept in winter,
yeah,
they might look a bit kind of, look like the fields outside our cities, mm. And in summer then spring, summer, they burst into life, and that also places us in time, because you might argue also, if you spend your time in a city and you never go out of a city, you lose a question of what's winter, what's summer, sure, what's spring, yeah, and whatever, because yeah, it always looks the same.
Yeah, sure.
And I think that would be a pretty, for me personally, a dull way to live.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
It's like the supermarket selling peppers all year, yeah, round or whatever.
Yeah,
there's no seasons. And I think I have the word fashion, and I don't think this is fashion. I think this is actually us about readopting what is fundamental to our actually survival.
Well, that's interesting, whether it's a fashion or it is something that's truly sustainable. You've got the technology, it's proven.
Yeah.
Regulation is coming in, and that's probably only going to increase.
Yeah.
But it's still relatively new territory for a lot of people. So there is still a big education piece of why people want it, and educating people into some of the comments you've made already, I wasn't aware of.
Yeah.
A lot of people wouldn't be aware of, and wouldn't think it forms part of the consideration for the built environment. So you need to expand people's knowledge and awareness. And is there enough going on in that regard to...
So yeah, no, I totally agree. And that is funny. I have conversations constantly. People are like, "Oh, I didn't know that." Or and I guess it's a small. I see people observing nature. People getting people to look at what they have, what they don't have, and even perhaps the rarity of our product currently, and people stumbling across it starts talking about it. And I do think it requires a movement of kind of what is normal, what is expected, and what is useful in terms of for biodiversity. I think biodiversity, as you say, is embodied carbon. The industry's starting to address it. We've got EPCs, EPD, there's kind of a load of certification coming out which is helping that, but biodiversity is quite new, and I know clients have always grappled with social impact, and we think we really address that, and it always seems a bit soft, and how do I really measure success on that? I think biodiversity, again, is that. I mean, what I can clearly say is if you go to any of our walls from spring to summer, you will see it, you'll hear it.
Yeah.
It's not an inert object.
Yeah,
and I think that's really the most exciting thing. So I think you really can feel and see it when you're kind of there. But I think for clients, this biodiversity journey is right at the beginning. And there needs to be, I mean, I think the Chelsea Flower Show last year talked about dandelions being hero plants for the first time. And there was this discussion. I think there was some carefully placed dandelions around the show, just to kind of show this is an important thing. But we also have grown from a world where we've kind of cut our kind of cloth, where the world has been very mineral, and I've done facades fully glazed, I've done crazy things around the world, and I kind of and I think there is a move from the design community to really embed that this into their kind of design. That, I mean, just around the corner from here, all these glazed towers, that's going to have to change.
I suppose the big challenge is we've ticked the people and the planet boxes. It's the profit, it's making sure that it's truly affordable.
Exactly.
Probably don't have time to go into that in this particular session, but I'd be certainly interested in your journey to find out how it does tick that economic viability box, because a lot of people need to be satisfied that this actually works and there isn't a long-term either maintenance issue or like that. But I know that you're satisfied that you can convince them on that front. But as I say, maybe keep that for another discussion. I didn't know, did I pick up that you're actually nominated for an Earthshot prize as well?
Yes, very exciting.
Paris Balcanita Earthshot.
It's a pleasant surprise. So we'll see whether we get any further, but it's very exciting that we've been recognised for what we're doing.
It'll help get the message out there.
Exactly.
Hopefully you'll come back and show us the award when you've won
it.
But look, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us, and best of luck with Vertical Meadow.
Brilliant, it's a pleasure, thank you.